smile, attracting my first potential with my irrepressible charm. Yet a bigger part of me wishes I was one of the mothers and could blend into the line of women behind me, unnoticed. It seems Connor is also experiencing trepidation. At first, he hops from foot to foot, rubbing his palms down his thighs in the navy trousers. But when he looks up at me, when our eyes meet, he visibly shrinks. His chest becomes concave, his knees knock inwards, and he seems to squirm. He stares at me, his dark eyes wide and disbelieving. "You're real," he swallows, finding it difficult to speak. "Of course," I reply, my voice sounding higher and lighter than normal, now I've got his pleasant bass tones to compare it with. "It's such a pleasure to meet you, Connor," I say, moving towards him.
I...
Looking horrified, he grips the table beside him and bends over, a hand cradling his stomach. "Are you unwell?" I ask, my eyes flicking towards the cameras I can see all around us, catching our every move. He shakes his head. "I'm fine," he mutters, through gritted teeth. Instinctively, I place my hand on his slim shoulder to reassure him. It's an alien environment for us both, and it's all I can do to offer him comfort. It's what the mothers would do for me, yet it doesn't prompt the same reaction. His body convulses beneath my touch, his knees buckling as he gulps for air. Suddenly, he throws his head backwards as his hands fly to his lips. The vomit spatters my face and clothes. The stench stings my nostrils. The bile burns my eyes. I close them, willing the whole thing away. I'm at a total loss as to what to do next.
"I'm so sorry," he whispers, his breathing as labored as my own.
"No, I shouldn't have..." I'm humiliated.
"You're Eve," he says softly, as though he's offering an explanation.
"So I'm told," I reply, wanting the exchange to be over, and wondering what's taking those around us so long to abort my first encounter. While the silence engulfs us, I'm hit with an overwhelming sense of failure. Before it consumes me, I wipe my hands across my face, then rub my eyes. Connor is blurred, but I can still register the horror on his face. "Thanks for coming, Connor," I manage to say, with as pleasant a smile as I can muster, then turn on my heels and head out of the door. No one stops me or tries to make me go back into the room. It would be callous of them to do such a thing, given the state of me, but the world is a strange place. In an instant, Mother Nina is at my side. We don't say a word as we get into the lift. Back in my room, I can't look at her wounded face as she helps me out of my stained dress. I try to ignore the sight of her shaking with silent sobs as I shower away the evidence of what occurred. I feel for her. I cannot shift the foul odor, no matter how hard I scrub. Likewise, I know I'll never be able to remove the ghastly memories now they've been etched into our world's history.
Chapter 5. Bram. The corridors outside our dorm are unusually busy for this time of night. News spreads fast inside the tower. Rumors spread faster. "Apparently he didn't last 5 seconds in the same room as her before showing her his breakfast," Hartman blurts. I roll my eyes at him. I know what happened. I was watching live in the gallery, where Eve's movements are monitored 24/7. I watched as potential number one blew his chance at saving the world. The now infamous Connor, aka Pukatential number one. I might have found it funny if it weren't for the years of work, thousands of hours of research, and an unthinkable amount of money that were wasted in a few seconds. Events like this are hard to conceal in here. They travel from the dome to the ground faster than the lift, and some version of today's incident will be whispered through the streets tonight. Of course, a fabricated photo is now being broadcast across all public reality TV stations to keep up appearances. Connor and Eve's perfect smiling faces projecting progress, to quash any rumors. Besides, any glimpse of Eve looking happy keeps the Freevers at bay for a while. perhaps long enough for the EPO to come up with a plan for potentials 2 and 3. "What's your old man going to say then?" Hartman asks, as he chucks a handful of his favourite mini cheese crackers into his mouth, wipes his greasy hands on his tight-fitting jumpsuit and picks up his notes on Eve's behavioural patterns since the meeting with Connor. "I've skimmed them, but my instincts know more about Eve than her ECG can tell me. I'm ready for tonight's emergency briefing." "You must be pretty pissed off, right?" Hartman continues when I don't reply. "Yeah," I shrug. "So, what's new?" Our dorm door swishes open automatically, the signal for us to leave. Our room floods with the raucous voices of my fellow pilots. Here we go. "Bram, is it true?" Jackson barks as we gather in the corridor. "About Connor?" I don't answer. "Oh, come on. You can't keep this from us. You can't have special privileges and not share the juicy stuff." The whole squad cracks up as we walk down the metallic corridor towards the briefing room. Jackson's always given me shit about my situation, about being the boss's son. "I'm sure we'll find out what happened in a few minutes," I say calmly, knowing they're all aware that I was in the gallery watching. Pilots aren't permitted there, but security turn a blind eye to Dr. Wells's son. "Okay, I see. Same old story with Daddy's boy, isn't it?" Jackson teases as he speeds up to walk next to me. "Keep all the inside knowledge for yourself. Don't want any of us getting closer to your precious Eve," he winks. The squad laugh. He's such a dick. "I don't know why they don't just scrap the potentials, open up the dome and let us all have a go at her. One of us is bound to..." My fist connects with his jaw and Jackson hits the floor. Hard. Shit. I shouldn't have done that. It was automatic. The whole squad has stopped and before I know what's happening, Jackson has my throat in his bear-sized hand and slams my face against the steel-plated wall. Ouch. Oh, and now I can't breathe. This is going well. I can't feel the floor under my feet anymore as he lifts me into the air and I feel the blood struggle to pass through the veins in my neck under the pressure of his grip. I instinctively try to pull his hand away, but his fat fingers feel more like biceps and my own hands flap uselessly as the colour fades from my vision. "Don't faint, Bram. Don't faint." "Jackson," I hear a voice cut calmly through the chaos. "If you'd be so kind as to kill my son quickly so we can get on with the more important task of saving humanity, I would very much appreciate it," says my father, Dr. Isaac Wells, before turning his back on us and entering the briefing room. Jackson gives my neck one last squeeze, then drops me into a heap on the floor. I've never felt so grateful for oxygen. "That was stupid," Hartman whispers as he grabs my elbow and helps me up. "Yeah," I agree, and we follow the squad into the darkened room. "Thanks, Dad." We take our seats at the back left of the briefing room. Same seats we've sat in for years, slightly elevated so we can see over the heads of our colleagues. I try to nurse the feeling back into my neck and catch a glimpse of Jackson rubbing the inside of his stubble cheek with his tongue. At least I hit him hard. "Good evening, gentlemen, or not so gentle, it would seem." My father flashes me a look over his frameless spectacles as he takes his position at the lectern in front of Squad H. I feel like a child. "I'm sure you've all heard the news about the disappointing result from potential number one, Connor Dobbs." He gestures with his hand and a video file from the meeting flickers to life on the reality TV monitor behind him. The pilots all watch what I saw happen earlier. Connor, sitting nervously in the cold, soulless meeting room. Whispers and giggles flutter around the room as we watch the footage. It's like being back at the academy. My father doesn't even blink. On the screen, Eve's security detail bursts through the door and then she appears, practically floating into the room in her white dress. I'd never seen her in something like that before today. The room falls silent at the sight. That's the problem. Even us pilots who see Eve on a daily basis are dumbstruck at the sight of her. Her hair, that dress, those eyes. Eve. She's mesmerizing. The room watches Connor struggle before the inevitable moment, but none of my fellow pilots is laughing now. I guess we're all protective of Eve, a new natural instinct, apart from Jackson, He's still just a dick. My father waves his hand and the footage stops. As you can see, we have a problem, he says. These potentials aren't like you and me. We constantly see and interact with Eve, so we are relatively immune to the effects of female presence. But most of these young men have never seen a woman in the flesh in their entire lives. His brown eyes scan the room and observe the faces now attentively staring at him. His graying hair curves backwards as if floating on invisible waves as his head darts between us. His team of six. Locke, Jackson, Kramer, Watts, Hartman, and myself, all sworn to obey his commands. Can you imagine being told you're potentially going to be a mate for the savior of humanity? All those emotions, those fantasies and nerves building up in you. Then imagine how it would feel coming face to face with her for the first time. He motions to the screen and Eve's photo appears, her flawless skin glowing in the light as her image rotates. It's no surprise that someone might have a physical reaction, and we should have foreseen it. So where do we come into this? Calls Locke eagerly from the front, voicing the question on everyone's mind. We just control Holly. We're not even permitted in the room when the encounters take place. What can we do? My father smiles and removes his glasses. Cue story. Do you know how I invented Holly? He asks, and I immediately know where he's going. The squad glance around the room. Bram, why don't you tell your fellow pilots? Thanks again, Dad. Holly was designed as Eve's social... I stop as Dad interrupts me by holding up his hand, pausing me like I'm one of his screens. Before that, Bram, how did I invent the technology, or better than that, why? I sigh. I can't believe he's making me say this. To satisfy the desires of men, I say, as professionally as I can. The room laughs. Well, that's partially correct. My technology has been sold for explicit uses in the past. How else could I fund my research? My father says. Squad H applaud and cheer him in jest. That's right, my dad, the virtual pimp, I add, and the team crack up. I designed a hologram technology so real, so lifelike that it could convince even the keenest observer of its authenticity. The room falls silent, ready to listen. Imagine the most highly skilled surgeon in the world, able to operate on someone from the other side of the planet just by interacting with a hologram of the patient. That was what my technology could do. It required the hologram to be so precise, so exact, that to tell it apart from a real human, you would need to run your hands through its light. It was from this technology that I created the Projectant program. Projectant program? Locke asks. I can't believe he doesn't know this stuff. They've all been in here too long. My father studies his glasses and cleans each lens with a single swipe as he considers delving into the program he was forced to abandon. The Projectant program, he sighs, his mind somewhere wonderful. Not computer-controlled holograms, but projections of real personality using real thoughts of real humans. The squad listen intently. At one time, these ideas were like wild science fiction, and people thought my father was insane. But his projectants actually worked. Back before most of you were born, my projectants were a serious consideration for what the EPO called existence extension. The idea that our minds could potentially continue to exist without the need for a physical body meant that the human race, in some form, would never become extinct. The female sex didn't need to die out if their minds could live forever. Mouths hang open. But that was all BE, he says, bringing himself back into the room. And before all of you, he chortles. Wait, what happened? Locke calls, desperate for more information. To the projectants. Once Eve was born, the projectant program was scrapped. All the focus turned to what was necessary to protect and nurture her. But Dr. Wells, Locke says, perhaps we'll discuss the projectant program another time. My father interrupts, obviously wanting to get back on track. Holly. Vivian feels it would be beneficial for the remaining potentials to spend a little quality time with Holly, as a sort of stepping stone to Eve. He finishes and looks around the room. Silence. You want us to use Holly to flirt with these guys? Asks Jackson, looking confused. The virtual pimp returns, jokes Kramer. I ain't doing that shit, Jackson scoffs, ever the alpha male. Dude, you've made a career out of pretending to be a girl. Get over it, Hartman heckles beside me, then slouches in his chair. I roll my eyes at him to shut up. When you've all quite finished, you'll find new briefing notes when you return to your dorms outlining the revised procedure with potential number two. As usual, there'll be no questions or debates. Thank you very much. You are all dismissed. Except Bram and Hartman. You two, remain in your seats, please. My father finishes the emergency briefing, and Squad H rise to their feet and file out of the room. It's not unusual for me and Hartman to stay behind, which Jackson can't stand. I'm sure he's not the only one. I may not be the team leader, but my long history with Eve makes our connection more natural. I know her, and she knows me. Or at least she knows my Holly. This means that occasionally Hartman and I are given different assignments from the rest of the squad. My father walks towards us and leans against the back of the seat in front of us. I see myself in his face. Behind the deep wrinkles in his pale, drooping skin, under the wisps of grey in his hair, I'm there. It's almost unheard of in this day and age to know who your true father is, let alone have any sort of relationship with him. I'm lucky. Or at least that's how I'm supposed to feel. It's how I used to feel, when I'd wander the walkways of Central a few paces behind him, seeing the fatherless, abandoned boys begging for scraps back when we lived out there. It's cloudy through the window of our apartment in the forest of concrete cloud scrapers. I'm young, 4 or 5. Where's your bag? My father barks. The grey hasn't appeared in his hair yet, but the wrinkles have begun to crease his face. Please, don't take him, he's too young! My mother screams, tears pooling in the wrinkles around her lower eyelids. Take one of your others, one from the streets. Take any of them, but not my boy. Not my boy! My father pushes past her, emotionless. He's my son, he stays with me. You have a direct order from the EPO to hand him over. If you wish to say goodbye, you must do it now. He barks. My mother runs to me, drops to her knees. She swallows hard and won't let the tears fall. Never forget me, my son, she whispers, leaning her forehead on mine, letting her dark curly hair close like curtains around our faces as she breathes in, like she's smelling me. She lifts a silver chain from around her neck, pulls it over her head and slips it over mine. A small cross swings from the bottom. That's enough. My father pulls my mother out of the way and edges me out of the front door. Once it slides shut behind us, I still hear her cry echoing in my mind. Bram, Hartman, how are you feeling? My father asks. Hartman shoots me a look. I was thinking. What did you say? I stutter, forcing the memories out of my head. Lack of sleep must be catching up with me. Dr. Wells asks how we're feeling, Hartman says, with a subtle squint of his eye in my direction. Dad never asks personal questions unless there's a specific reason. There's always a motive. For my father, a conversation is a scientific experiment to which he already has a desired result. He just needs to find the right method to achieve it. Right now, he's trying kindness. It doesn't suit him. I'm fine, sir. Hartman says. I nod in agreement. So you're both fit and rested, he probes. We look at each other and nod. Then suit up and make your way to the studio. Eve is awake and expecting Holly. He drops a file on my lap and leaves the room. I glance at Hartman. Open it, he says, so I peel off the red tape and open the brown folder. A dozen photos slip onto my lap. Photos of Eve. She's wearing a white dressing gown. Her wild hair is refusing to be tamed by the band holding her plaits, and her face is red and blotchy. The room around her is completely trashed and the feathers from inside her pillow hang in the air. This must be after the meeting. Hartman states the obvious. It's going to be a long night. Chapter 6. Bram. The locker room is deserted. No one else is working so late. It's me and Hartman. Just how we like it. I walk past my co-pilot's lockers, Jackson, Locke, Kramer, Watts. They'll all be back in their dorms, reading through their new assignments, but they'll be wondering what Hartman and I are up to. There's nothing new, me and Hartman getting summoned out of hours for unscheduled meetings with Eve. Life isn't always predictable. Sometimes Eve needs us, and we have to be there. Tonight is one of those nights. There's no agenda for Holly on tonight's assignment. She's simply going to be who Eve needs her to be. Her friend. There is no script, no key messaging, pure improvisation. That's why I'm here, not Jackson or Kramer. They may outrank me, but they don't know Eve like I do. If Eve wants to talk about her childhood, I know it. I was there. They have to wait for Locke or Watts to load up a history file and find the information they require to have a successfully convincing conversation. Not me. We open our lockers, and I pull out my thin black kinetic suit. It's well worn, but still as state-of-the-art as they come. Millions of microscopic sensors line flexible fabric, ready to capture my every movement. I strip naked and slip it on. It forms around my muscles like a second skin. Being a pilot requires a certain level of physical fitness, and the job itself keeps me in shape. It's demanding. I grab my visor, head strap, and pressure gloves, and turn to face Hartman, who's been busy programming tonight's assignment on his laptop on the bench next to me, a strip of red licorice poking out of his thick lips. His job is more mentally demanding than physical. It takes two people to pilot Holly, the programmer and the pilot. Hartman is my programmer, my co-pilot. If Holly walks out onto the drop and Eve grabs a jacket, Hartman programs one for me too and it appears in Holly's hands. If Eve wants to gossip over a late night snack, Hartman makes me a virtual mug of tea. He controls every aspect of Holly's appearance and everything she digitally interacts with during a session with Eve. Is he the best at it? Maybe not. He'd be the first to admit that. But he makes up for what he lacks by finding ways around the system. Are they always legal? Hell no. But if it gets the job done, the EPO are usually happy to overlook his hacking tendencies. They want results. They don't care how they get them. My job? I am Holly. My movements, my mannerisms, my physicality. It's all captured by the hypersensitive pressure points that are woven into the kinetic suit. My facial expressions are analyzed, adapted, and applied to Holly's face in real time, as is my voice. When I'm suited up, I am Holly. When I enter the studio two floors below the dome, Bram stays at the door. This is my duty, my part in the future. I am Holly. I've loaded up the night program we used a few months back. It's not perfect, but it's the best I've got at short notice, Hartman says, swiveling his screen around to show me Holly's appearance, how Eve will see me. That'll work fine, I say, my mind already shifting. I'm numbing Bram's emotions, Bram's feelings, switching off from my father, ignoring the ache in my neck from Jackson's fist. They are not Holly's issues, they are Bram's. I am Holly. We enter the darkened studio, and I hear the electric hum of the scanners warming up, and the static electricity in the air emits small blue sparks on my visor as it slips over my cropped dirty blonde hair. The room is large, big enough to run in if I need to. It can simulate any event or environment that Holly might encounter in the dome with Eve. I flip the visor down in front of my eyes and prepare for connection. Whatever Holly sees up there, I see down here. Whatever I do down here, Holly does up there. We are connected. We are the same person. I am Holly. Okay, Holly is loaded and ready for connection, I hear Hartman in my earpiece. Ready, Bram? I don't reply. Sorry, ready, Holly? He corrects himself. 4 years together and he still can't get the basics right. Ready, idiot, I reply, and shoot him a look through my visor as he sits behind his control station, illuminated by a subtle red light in the corner of the studio. Good luck. Rendering Holly now. Connection in 3, 2, 1, he says in my ear, as the dome appears in front of me. I look around at the dark greenery. I'm standing in the upper garden zone, a little walk from Eve's sleeping quarters, and I remember the night program Hartman has loaded from a few weeks back. Sorry, I forgot to change the location, his voice crackles in my ear. A few weeks ago, Eve and I took a late-night stroll through the garden. She was anxious about the potentials and wasn't sleeping well. Holly's assignment was to help her relax. I walk past the trees and flowers as they glow in the blue light cast by the incredibly large full moon looming over my head on the other side of the hexagonal canopy. It's nothing like the real moon, more like the one you see in your dreams. The perfect kind that floats effortlessly, magically, over the world. This is Eve's moon. I see the light from her room at the top of a small spiral staircase and I walk up it. The studio floor beneath my feet reacts to what I'm doing and moves silently to simulate the experience of walking upstairs. I reach the top and stand in front of a full-length glass door. I stop for a moment and take in my reflection. Pastel pink pajamas. Natural blonde hair with a subtle wave. Piercing green eyes. Thin lips and a pointy jaw make Holly elfishly pretty. Then my focus adjusts from my programmed pretty features to the naturally beautiful Eve. I can see her sad eyes staring out at me. She hides her face in what remains of her pillow. I press my thumb to my little finger, which holds Holly's position momentarily and mutes my voice from the dome, allowing me to speak to Hartman without Eve hearing. Don't open the door, I tell him, preempting what he was about to do. She'll let me in. I release my fingers and raise a hand to tap on the glass. My kinetic gloves vibrate as I knock. It feels real. I hear the sound of my simulated knock echo around the inside of Eve's small bedroom. Not tonight, Holmes. Eve's voice is muffled by the pillow. I don't reply. I give her a moment. She turns her head and looks at me again. I just want to be alone. She sniffs as more tears run sideways down her face. Come on, Eve. Let me in? I ask. She doesn't move. I don't want to. We don't have to talk. Let's just sit, I suggest. She looks at me. She's thinking. She knows I could just come in if they wanted me to. The doors can be unlocked with the click of a button. Everything can be controlled remotely in the dome. But I like giving her the control. This is her place. Not mine. Not the EPO's. Eve, you can trust me. It's me, I say. Through the translucent visor, I see Hartman's head give me a look. Perhaps I emphasized me a little too much. Eve looks more closely this time. She stares through the glass door into Holly's eyes. It's like she's looking through my visor and into my own. She knows. She immediately climbs down from her bed, steps over the mess she's created and swings the glass door open. She raises her arms, places them around my neck and sobs. She can't feel me. Not really. Touching Holly is like touching a ball of static. They made us do it repeatedly at the academy. It's warm, fizzy, but not real. We're not supposed to touch Eve physically. Vivian thinks it breaks the illusion of reality, but tonight's an exception. Tonight Eve needs it. She holds the weight of her own arms, places her cheek on my shoulder and accepts the sensation on her face. My suit reacts and lets me feel the weight of her and the soft tremor of her chest as she cries. My stomach jumps at this simulated embrace, holding her. This isn't something many people get to do. I say nothing and wait for her to run out of tears as we stand in the light of her moon. Let's walk, she says, as she takes my hand and leads me down the staircase. I know where she's going, and as we reach the bottom step, I speed up to walk alongside her. We silently move through the greenery towards the opening in the canopy. I see the wind blow through the strands of her curly brown hair that have broken free of the plaits and glance at my wrist. In a matter of seconds, Hartman has understood my gesture and the next time I look at my wrist, a hairband is waiting there. I let go of Eve's hand for a moment, pull it off, and tie my blonde hair away from my face to match hers as we step through the opening onto the drop. "So," she sighs. "Good day, then," I say sarcastically. "Fab," she smirks, giving me a thumbs up. "All went according to plan. I can already hear those wedding bells." I chuckle, and she looks out over the sea of clouds below us. "It won't be like that again, Eve," I say. "Won't it?" she asks. "You should have been there, Holes. You could barely look me in the eye. It was like my face was..." She stops and shakes her head. "It wasn't anything to do with your face. It wasn't anything you did. It wasn't your fault in any way at all." She looks at me in disbelief. "This was a complete and utter screw-up by them." I nod towards the nearest camera invading our conversation. "And believe me, they know it. I mean, of course these guys are going to be dumbstruck when they see you. You're the only girl on the planet. It's pretty obvious, if you ask me. And they should have taken that into consideration before marching you into a room with a potential." Eve smiles. "I know I shouldn't have referenced the camera or insulted the EPO's actions, but I have the authority here to do what needs to be done to gain Eve's cooperation." "I don't think they're going to be happy with you saying things like that," Eve teases. "Yeah, well, sometimes you've got to peel the stickers off the cube," I joke and stick my middle finger up at the camera. Eve cracks up and covers my hand with her own. "That's what you've always said." "It's true." She's back. We sit on the drop for hours as Eve's moon creeps overhead. We talk about life, about the world, the future, men, love, everything. She's interested, inquisitive, smart. "So who's next?" she asks. "I'm sorry?" I reply, wondering what she's talking about. "Potential number two. Who is he?" "Oh, he's nice," I tell her, raising my eyebrows knowingly. "No, really, I think you'll like this one," I say as convincingly as I can, knowing that the next potential is about as dull as cardboard. "Why can't they just be like you?" She's taking in the view. "Well, not everyone's perfect," I joke. "Besides, I think we'd find the whole repopulating the planet thing a little tricky, if you know what I mean." "No, I mean you," she says, turning to look straight through Holly's eyes, down two stories, past my visor and into my own. My heart stops. The hairs on my skin stand on end and I freeze. Is she talking to me? I'm speechless. Completely blindsided. My mind slips from Holly and I'm myself, face to face with Eve. She's never done this before. "Bram!" I hear Hartman calling into my earpiece, snapping me back to reality. Eve's reality. "Is it morning already?" Eve asks, as we shield our eyes from the intense sunrise creeping over the distant horizon. The answer is no. This is Vivian ending our meeting. "I think you should get some sleep, Eve. Go back, shut the blinds and rest. Forget about today. It won't happen again." She looks into my eyes once more, and I nervously tuck my hair behind my ears, forgetting that I'd already tied it back. Shit, I'm shaking. Okay, night, Holes. Thanks," she says as she walks towards the doorway. She waves over her head as she yawns and disappears inside, leaving me alone on the drop. I turn and gaze at the sunrise, which hasn't moved since it first appeared. It's paused. I chuckle to myself as the display in my visor begins to fade and Hartman's voice irritates my eardrum. "Disconnection in 3, 2, 1, you're clear." I sit on the floor, pull off the headset and unzip my kinetic suit. I'm sweating. "That girl's going to get us into trouble," I say as Hartman closes his laptop and walks over to where I'm slumped. "No, she's not," he replies. "She's going to get you into trouble."
Chapter 7. Eve. "And 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, brush through the floor and into 5th. Lovely, Eve," says Mother Jackie in her soothing voice, which she modulates to enhance the direction she's giving. Not only is she one of the youngest of the mothers, but she's also the most agile.
Even though she's almost 70, she can still touch her toes and bring her foot up behind her ear. Until recently, she could also outrun me. I'm not sure whether I've become faster or she's become slower, but either way, those qualities have made her responsible for Holly's and my physical education. This covers everything from swimming to ballet, netball to gymnastics, karate to running, all to keep me fit and active, to make sure my body is in full working order and prepared for what's to come. I've never complained. There's no denying the release that comes with exerting myself. The buzz makes me feel alive as the blood rushes through me, into my fingers and toes, especially when I'm boxing. They hang up a bag and let me hook, jab, kick, and punch to the rhythm of the music. I always feel exhausted when I leave and more alive than ever. In contrast to the aggression I love in boxing, they give me dancing, which always leaves me exhilarated, sometimes even enchanted. Especially ballet, which is such an emotive form of storytelling. When I was younger, I used to sit and watch Mother Jackie twirl and spin around the room in awe. I'm allowed to watch old footage of staged productions every now and then. They were grand affairs in huge theatres, where everyone got dressed up as though it was quite the event. I understand why. The emotion, the detail, the magic. A body can express so much in the way it moves. It takes me somewhere else. It's captivating. I'm not at that level, but in many ways I feel like I am when I'm in class. In those moments, when I close my eyes, I'm transported. Not to a stage where I'm watched by an audience of thousands. I'm watched enough already. But to an empty auditorium where I perform only for me. Where I dance to the beat of my own drum. Occasionally I open my eyes and I'm surprised to be in the dance studio. This is exactly what I've needed to calm my mind after the incident with Connor. In this room, none of that matters. I sense Holly behind me, breathing deeply after an intense class of point work. I always feel sorry for her in these classes. She's not a natural. Now bring your right arm up and over and lean slowly into the bar. Mother Jackie's voice is low and breathy as she demonstrates what she's asking of us. Feel that pull. Keep your arm long, Holly. Holly grunts in response. Plie and stretch, Mother Jackie sings, and lower into a reverence. I do as she instructs, my body thankful as it bows into the curtsy and welcomes the end of the session. Well done, she smiles, giving a little clap, clearly happy with our progress. She walks to the corner of the room and pulls her uniform grey trousers over her ballet tights, then slips her feet into her black shoes and her pale pink blouse over her head. Plain, except for the embroidered white logo to the left of her chest. This is the everyday uniform of the mothers. It's practical and nondescript. That's another reason why I love to see Holly walking into a room with her ever-changing wardrobe choices. It gives me something new to look at. Oof, that was a tough one, I puff, once Mother Jackie has left the room. I grab the bar with both hands, then lean over to lengthen my spine. You're improving, Holly says. I look up to see her wearing a patronizing grin. They've been working me hard, I say matter-of-factly, straightening up. Holly's wearing an identical outfit to my own, pink tights and a black crossover leotard. They've even made me have another go at Mandarin. Again? Well, if you haven't mastered it by now, you never will. Thanks for the encouragement. She falters. She never fluffs, which makes me think she pities me for what happened at the first encounter. I clench my jaw. Then I open my mouth and out comes some broken Mandarin. What? She asks, her brow dipping in confusion. Exactly, I laugh. Amused that I managed to quote Sylvia Plath in Mandarin. Potential number two looks decent, she says, jumping on my good mood. He does, I say dismissively. Soon I have to meet Diego. I was distraught after Connor. Holly came to see me afterwards, but not this Holly. I can't be as open and raw with this one. There are three Hollies. This is a fact that has never been confirmed or spoken about, but I know it's true. They look and sound the same, but aside from the minute differences in their eyes, There are also tiny traits that give them away and help me to tell them apart. This one talks at me, not to me, as though she knows best. Arguably, she does know more than I do on subjects they like to keep from me, but still, it's irritating to see her enjoying that. She wears a permanent smirk. In my head, I refer to her as Know-It-All Holly. She's the one I'm usually a little more cautious with. Next, there's I Concur Holly, who just agrees with everything I say, no matter how ludicrous. She usually joins me in my academic classes, but I hardly ever see her in my downtime. And finally, there's Holly. Just Holly. The one who's always been here. The one I trust above anyone I've ever met, even though I've never actually met her. There were others, too, before Know-It-All and I Concur. Hollies I formed heartfelt bonds with. I was sad to see them replaced. Hurt that they'd been taken in that way. I think about them every so often and wonder what became of them. As for these three, there's no denying I have my favorite, but I'm always pleased whenever Holly turns up. No matter which version she is, I'm always glad of her company. Even this one, most of the time. What happened with Connor was unfortunate, she says, choosing her words carefully while rearranging the strap of her leotard. It's a conversation I'd rather not have with her. I don't want to rehash it. I like his curly hair, I say quickly, turning her focus back on Diego, preferring the conversation to be steered forwards rather than backwards. I know, dark and gorgeous, it looks so soft. Her comment is as pathetic as my own, but I ignore the voice in my head telling me so. He's good with numbers, apparently. And knows a lot about history, I tell her. Even though I hadn't been too keen to find out more about the next potential, too embarrassed to go through it again so soon, he'd caught my attention when I'd heard of his interests. Really? So I've been told. I wonder whether he studies the same history as us. Of course he does. What else would he study? She laughs as though I'm daft. We study ancient history, I remind her, my tone flat. And? She asks. As though anything that occurred after the Greeks and Egyptians is worthless. I wonder how it'll work, I mumble, fighting the urge to roll my eyes at her. Well, you've been talked through the new procedure. She almost tuts, as though she's irritated at having to explain it when Vivian already has. You'll be wearing a veil this time and stay behind Mother Nina. I'll be up front, leading the conversation. I meant me hearing of things that I shouldn't know about the outside world, I interrupt. You know everything. You think? I challenge, almost laughing at her statement. Did you see he's from Peru? She asks, her eyebrows rising. And where are you from? She shakes her head disparagingly. Don't make things so difficult, Eve. It was an innocent question, I shoot back, even though I know I'm pushing boundaries. You've never told me, I mutter, sitting on the floor to take off my pumps, my toes reveling in their freedom. Holly doesn't pander to me. Instead, we stretch in silence until she deems enough time has passed for her to probe again. Is there anything in particular you want me to ask him tomorrow? She replies, taking us back to the topic they want her to focus on as she mirrors my action on the floor. It's been decided Holly will sit in my place while I blend in with the mothers and observe. It's an arrangement I'm more than happy with. To blend. To be a part of the motherhood. To be rid of the burden of being engaging and desirable. I'd like to know his first thought when he wakes up in the morning, I say. This was the one question I wanted to ask Connor before our meeting was cut short. Really? Yes. That initial thought, when your eyes open and you take in a new day, cannot be controlled, I say, pulling my ankles into my bottom and enjoying the tug on my inner thigh muscles. It's pure. I wonder if he wakes up feeling lucky to be alive or grateful for the Earth's beauty. Holly looks perplexed. That's okay to ask, right? I rarely ask her advice, not this one, but on this occasion the bewilderment on her face leads me to do so. You can ask whatever you like, she says softly. What's your first thought, in case he asks in return? Each morning, I open my eyes to the most beautiful sunrise. I see the wonder that is nature and experience a thrill at the thought of being the one who can keep us here. Holly nods, seemingly in a daze, her gaze fixed on her ankles. That thrill quickly turns into an overwhelming weight of responsibility, and I long to go back to sleep, I admit, revealing a touch more bitterness than I mean to. I'll leave that bit out, she says flatly. If you like. I get to my feet. I better go. I have to shower before we have the next round of Mandarin. I'll see you there, she calls, as I leave the room. Holly will. She won't. Chapter 8. Eve. A bony hand squeezes my shoulder, waking me. As I open my eyes, I'm confused to find Mother Nina hovering above me. Her mouth stretches wide while her cheeks wrinkle into a smile. In my sleepy state, she's like an angel, her snow-white hair illuminating the top of her head like a halo in the darkness. Darkness. The observation startles me as I look past her to the sky outside. It's pitch black, not the dawn I'm used to being greeted with. It's night time. Somewhere between yesterday and tomorrow. Tomorrow. Today. It's almost time to meet the second potential. But not just yet. Come, Mother Nina whispers, waving an armful of clothes at me. I frown, taking in the scene, my brain slow. But the meeting, I find myself mumbling. We'll be back in time. We're going out, I ask in surprise, waking up properly. Mother Nina smiles, confirming my conclusion. I throw back the covers, energized at this unexpected turn of events. It takes me seconds to get dressed in the black top and joggers she has selected for me. I don't wait for her to faff and fuss as she usually does. I reject our usual formalities. I want to go. As soon as I finish tying up the shoelaces on my trainers, I turn to Mother Nina with a nod, letting her know I'm ready. She leads me to the steps out of my bedroom, down the stairs, through the dimly lit gardens and to the lift. I've rarely been out here at this hour. The place seems eerily quiet without the other mothers milling around and getting on with their daily tasks. The silence is almost deafening. I take a deep breath as the doors close on us and the lift drops. The descent feels never-ending, as though we're going down for ages. But of course, we are. We're going down, down, down to the ground. Down to the outside world. Something in my chest expands at the thought, my lips stretching into a smile that I try to suppress. The doors open onto the cold, grey collection bay. Not quite outside in the elements, but it's one step closer. The chill of the morning air is tickling my cheeks. Ketch is standing to attention next to a black car. Its solid back door has been left open for us to climb inside. We do so willingly, longingly, expectantly. It's always like this. I'm happy and content in the dome, of course I am, but when I think of being outside, I long to explore a world I rarely see. A hunger bubbles up and I want to ingest as much as I can before they take me back to the home they chose for me. Once Mother Nina and I are in our black leather seats, Ketch shuts the door with a bang, putting us into darkness, thanks to the windowless bubble we're caged in. The inside of the car becomes a heavily padded cell. Within seconds, subtle lights fade up, allowing us to see a little more. Although there's not much to look at. Sitting in our comfortable spots at the back, we hear Ketch getting into the driver's seat and closing the door with a dull thud. That tells me it's just the three of us. Our trip isn't a big state affair. It's more personal, special, and intimate. My heart sings at the realization of where we're going. The car moves forward and I hug myself because I know we're on our way to the happiest of places. I envisage us moving away from the dome, through the city and the towns on its outskirts, enjoying the way my body sways as Ketch turns corners or hits the brakes. The rhythm is calming yet thrilling. I lean my head back and close my eyes. As usual, we seem to drive for hours, which makes me wonder what time it is if we need to get back for the next encounter. I don't ask Mother Nina. I don't want her cutting our trip short or, worse, changing her mind and having us turn back before we reach our destination. It's been so long since they last brought me here. The roads beneath us become more uneven. I can feel it in the way the car moves. What's more, I recognize the dips and turns. We're getting closer. Eventually, we slow down. We stop. My heart flutters. The mechanics keeping me in the back of the car moan as Ketch opens the door and sets me free. It's not as dark as it was when Mother Nina woke me. The sky is lightening. We must be nearing dawn now. I climb out, feeling the crunch beneath my feet as my shoes hit the gravel. The sound causes my lips to twitch into a smile. While I step away from the vehicle, I breathe in the familiar smell of jasmine, rose, bluebell and lily of the valley wafting around me. I hear birds chirping and water trickling, which fills me with joy. I've been coming here for years. Vivian brought me here first. When we got into the car, she revealed they'd found me a garden outside, a place in the real world that was for me alone. When she first told me, I didn't care what it looked like. It could have been a patch of dirt for all I cared. I was simply overwhelmed that a patch of something out here was going to be mine. I was blown away when I arrived to find a meadow in full bloom with a stream trickling through the middle. I asked why they'd allowed me to come here, but all the while I couldn't stop smiling as I took it all in. I could tell Vivian was pleased by my reaction. I was so grateful that I hugged her. She let me and whispered into my hair that it was all for me. All mine. We ran through shrubs and played for hours. I can picture Vivian here, smiling as we played hide-and-seek. I hear our laughter rising to the leaves high above. I felt closer to her than ever before. She's not been back here with me since, even though I know she felt as I did. Her joy wasn't faked or forced. It was genuine. She was kind, friendly, and affectionate. But after that day, she distanced herself from me. A veil dropped between us and she became an authority figure, judging my every move. Our day here together has become a memory I find myself questioning. It was so different from how we are now. Holly has never come either, but that makes sense, of course. She couldn't. She wouldn't function in the open air of the real world. The drop is her limit. I open my eyes and keep walking. I lose myself in the leafy green, the comfort of the scent and the sound of running water. When I get to the stream, I drop to the ground. The air seems richer here, damp and dewy in the morning light that's slowly creeping upon us. I sit and listen, watching the birds fly overhead. The trees dance in the breeze and the water ripples. In the dome, I have the drop to escape to. I love it up there, perched above the clouds with Holly at my side. Here, amid nature, I feel less isolated but stronger than ever. I'm empowered to do all I can to ensure humanity survives, surrounded by such beauty. This is nature's doing. Here, no one prunes the overgrown bushes like we do in the dome. Instead, everything's allowed to grow as it likes. It flourishes of its own accord. Sometimes I feel I'd like to be a single bloom here, a rose allowed to follow her own course. Mother Nina has followed me from the car and perched behind me. Her eyes are closed as she, too, loses herself in the tranquility of a peaceful morning setting. What must it be like for her to be so far from the world she grew up in? At least I don't know anything different. Her forehead creases in thought, half a dozen lines becoming deeper than usual. Perhaps a memory from that time long ago. "Thank you for bringing me here," she nods, her eyes remaining shut. We stay like that for a few moments until she says, "I've got a gift for you." She pulls a little package, wrapped in brown paper, from her bag. "A book," I predict with excitement. I've always imagined that books out here are like the clothes they give me in the dome, a gargantuan quantity just waiting for me. They don't give me a limitless stream of books. I know they hold some back from me because most of the ones I've read were written hundreds of years ago. I've made a note of their publication dates. I've not read anything written within the last 70 years or so, maybe more. I asked about it once. I wanted to know why there was such a gap in literature. Naturally, I was curious. There is so much I don't know. Vivian told me that many decades before, technology had taken over, so there had been no need to produce actual books. But that was all. I've learnt to be thankful for what I receive and keep certain thoughts in my head. Greed is an ugly sin, and I know I should want no part of it. Yet, I experience a surge of joy when I receive something new. It's not a book, exactly, she says. Oh? Well, it is. It's just... open it. I laugh at her uncharacteristic loss for words and rip apart the paper eagerly. What's this? I ask, inspecting the object in my hands. It's more like a notebook, like the ones I use in the schoolroom, although with its black leather finish, it's far more luxurious. My hand grips its spine while I thumb the pages, glimpsing what's inside. My heart stops at the handwriting. It's your mother's, Mother Nina says quietly. I turn to the first page and a lump forms in my throat. Letters to My Baby by Corinne Warren. You don't know me yet, but I'm your mother. You might not call me mother, you might choose mama, mummy, or mum, but whichever it is will more than suffice. I can't wait to hear you call me. I can't wait to see you grow. But more than anything, I can't wait to hold you in my arms and to know you're safe. My life will be complete when you're in the world with your father and me. But until then, this is a little gathering of letters from me to you, from mother to babe. Why haven't I seen this before? I ask. Mother Nina's face is pensive but stern. It's best to focus on the fact that you have it now, Eve. Please learn that not all battles should be fought, especially those that start with good intentions. I look back to the book in my hands and run my fingers over my mother's words. Words she wrote for me to read. I could sit and read all of it in one go, thinking about how her hand must have glided across the page as she dreamt of our future together. I could soak up every little detail of who she was, what she wanted for me, and ponder over whether anything has been realized. But I don't want to rush through the only tangible thing that's passed between us. The opening paragraph is enough for now. I place the book against my chest and hold it there. I feel more complete, almost whole. I take Mother Nina's hand in mine, stroking her thin and wrinkled skin with the other. She may not be my real mother, but she is here and has bridged the gap. This isn't how I expected the day to start, but I'm glad it has. Time passes while I enjoy the setting, the warmth of Mother Nina's hand in mine, and the feeling of promise that swells inside me at the thought of what awaits me. For once, everything feels real. Chapter 9. Eve. I fall asleep in the car on the way back, which isn't surprising in view of the early start, the overload to my senses of being outside, and the emotion that's flooded me. The first thing I do when I'm back in my room, sitting on my bed, is open the book of letters, reread the first paragraph, kiss the page, and bury it under my pillow. I'm desperate to carry on, but it's getting late. The mothers will come in soon to get me ready, and I don't want them seeing it or talking about it. Not yet. For a second, I find myself wondering whether Vivian knows I've got it, but of course, she knows everything. Does that matter? That's a question for another day. I have been handed an unexpected gift from my mother. In lots of ways, wise old Mother Nina was right about choosing where to channel my energy. My chest swells at the thought of coming back to my mother's handwriting a little later. But now, I must focus on the day ahead and the encounter with potential number two. The mothers enter en masse and start to get me ready. It's noticeably calmer than last time. There's less of a buzz as they go about their tasks. Or perhaps I'm setting the tone. I'm more relaxed than before. Being at the stream has conquered my nerves, while the gift of my mother's words has propelled me into the day ahead. I'm eager for the meeting, of course, but I'm looking forward to afterwards and spending time alone with my mother's notebook. Perhaps the mothers are mirroring what I'm projecting. We fall into silence as I'm handed a pretty dress, similar to the one I wore for my last meeting. Only this time it's hidden beneath the uniform of the mothers. Similarly, my hair is styled and then hidden. My makeup is perfected. As Mother Nina pins my headscarf into place, she lets out a sigh of dismay. My longest-serving friend has been pensive since we got back. Her wrinkled face is a